Acts chapter 18 is where we've left off. You may remember at the beginning of this chapter, we've got Paul. He goes to the city of Corinth. He meets up with two people. We don't know if they are Christians or not, but they are important New Testament characters. At some point, they certainly do become Christians. And anybody remember the names, husband and wife? It was, all right, Priscilla and Aquila, or Aquila and Priscilla, depending on who you want to mention first. They were both, well, their trade was they were tent makers. They could have been leather makers. A lot of translations, though, will render that tent makers. Paul begins to stay with them, and he begins to preach the gospel. I want to go back to about verses 3 and 4, and we got down to almost verse 6, a little bit of verse 6 last week. We talked about the blood and so forth, but there were a couple of things we didn't get to. All right, so he's reasoning, verse 4, Acts chapter 18, in the synagogue every Sabbath. He is persuading Jews and Greeks. But here's the contrast. Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia. Paul was constrained by the word, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. That verb testifying, I didn't tell you this information. It's a verb which is used some other places in the New Testament, and I think those other places give you some pretty good visuals. You remember over there in Luke chapter 16, it's Luke chapter 16 and verse 28, the rich man, as he's suffering in the Hadean realm, the unpleasant side of Hades, he says he wants his, Lazarus to go back and do what to his brothers? He wants his brothers to receive testimony. He wants Lazarus to go back and testify. Now, what kind of preacher do you think he wanted Lazarus to be? You should probably be do right and serve God. What do you think was the testifying?
He was warning
them. Earnestness. Passion. I mean, it was, you be on fire. You go tell them with every ounce of strength that you have. So if you know that it's used in that context, you can begin to, I think, appreciate the intensity that Paul is using here. It's also used, interestingly, didn't know this until I looked, Acts chapter 2 and verse 40. Peter testified. He exhorted. Peter wasn't a wimpy preacher on the day of Pentecost that said, well, you know, Christ rose from the dead. You guys should probably become Christians. You know, he stood up and preached and said, you guys are in sin. You killed the Son of God. You need to repent or you're going to perish. Who wants to become a Christian? Here's how to do it. So you have, as far as this kind of preaching, it was bold, it was courageous, it was to the point. And Paul used this word in the Thessalonian letter, 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 6, to say that if you neglect that testimony, you should expect to be punished by God. Now, having said that, let's move down to Acts chapter 18 and verse 6. We touched on some of this last week. Carol was kind enough to find Nehemiah chapter 5 and verse 13, which is a really good cross-reference. And it was in Nehemiah, and she helped nail that as far as he is going to go to the Gentiles. And when they had opposed themselves and blasphemed, he shook out his raiment and said unto them, your blood be upon your own heads. I'm clean. From henceforth I will go unto the Gentiles. If you've ever done some cooking, and maybe you did this for Thanksgiving, you were wearing your apron, and maybe you dealt with some flour, or you had something else, and you thought, how am I going to clean my apron off? Anybody ever shake an apron? Or you maybe have the fellow who is the woodworker, or you have somebody who deals with metal, and they've got their apron on, and they'll go, and they'll just shake. Or maybe, if we haven't had those experiences, what about the hairstylist? You go in, they put the little apron or gown on you, and then your hair clippings are all there, and then depending on how they operate, but a lot of them will just say, just flick that off, shake that off, or they'll come by and they'll blow dry it off. What are we saying about those clippings, those metal shavings, or those wood clippings, or the hair clippings? When we do that, we say they're not important. You know, they're junk, they're scrap. We can get rid of these. So we talked about the fact that if you, as a Jew, shook your foot off, symbolically, I mean, you weren't actually trying to shake off any dirt. At least I don't think that was true for most of them. But symbolically, we don't want anything to do with you. Sometimes a person will say, I'm fed up. And they'll put their hands up in an expression symbolically to say, I'm through with you. I don't want to have anything more to do with you. But when you perhaps take off your jacket or your coat, I mean, that is sort of the advanced level as far as shaking and saying, I want nothing to do with you people at all. And Nehemiah 5 verse 13 expresses that very, very well. What I didn't tell you, along with those illustrations, is a little information about the word opposed. That is a present tense verb, which you probably wouldn't be too surprised at. They were continuing to rebel. They were continuing to resist what Paul was trying to teach. But Paul uses this same word in the book of Romans. Anybody remember the context of Romans chapter 13? What's he talking about in Romans 13? He's talking about civil government, civil authority, civil powers. And he says there are some people who resist the government. Well, isn't that true in our time? But they resist in all kinds of ways. I mean, especially with COVID right now, the government, Louisiana, I think you had the preacher down there, he was resisting to the point where the case was considered as far as a possible course for the Supreme Court. Did you see the one, I think it's in Michigan, about the Big Boy restaurant? Anybody see that? This guy was told to shut down, and Big Boy pulled the franchise. They said, if you're going to continue to risk the government, you will not be a Big Boy's restaurant. So they lost the Big Boy franchise, but now they're the Big Boy Diner or something like that. Or they're the something diner. They had to get rid of the Big Boy. But there are people who resist for different reasons. Political reasons, religious reasons. Along with this resistance, Paul experienced people who were blaspheming. That's also expressed with the present tense. That would describe abusive. That would describe evil speech. And one of the things that I didn't know about blasphemy, you know, you typically think about Jesus and the blasphemy that he experienced or the blasphemy that he talked about. But this word blasphemy, it's used in 14 New Testament books. It occurs 35 times in the New Testament, and it's used by 8 different writers. I'd never connected it that way, but blasphemy is a big, big thing in Scripture. And sometimes that railing, that hateful, that abusive speech, blasphemous speech, we still see it today. We typically don't label speech. We hear something, we say, well, he committed blasphemy. I mean, that's kind of something that maybe in my mind people did in Bible times, but people still do it today. All right. I think I may have touched on this as an example of casting our pearls before swine in Acts chapter 18. And what did Paul do? Did he do what Jesus said? Rather than cast your pearls before swine, you have the right, you have the ability to walk away. And sometimes that's hard. Sometimes we don't want to do that, especially if there are people that we really love. But if we do that, and this is where we ended last time, we are free from the what of all men. We picked up from Ezekiel chapter 33 this information. We're free from the blood. We're free from the accountability. I have warned you that you're going to fall off the cliff. I have warned you that you're going to get killed. I have warned you that you're going to suffer great serious injury. And if you do that, you've been warned. And companies do that all the time with a warning. Warning. From before you can touch the item in the box, you've got warning labels slapped on it. Do not do this. Okay, let's pick up then, unless you have a question, with Acts chapter 18, 1 through 6. I'll look at verses 7 and 8. Anybody want to add or ask anything? Let's look there now. And the story continues. He departed thence and went into the house of a certain man named Titus Justus, one that worshipped God, whose house joined hard to the synagogue. And Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord with all his house, and many of the Corinthians hearing believed and were baptized. There were several people who did not want to hear what Paul had to say. They were involved with that blaspheming and the resisting and so forth, but some were. And one of the fellows that wanted to hear is this guy named Titus Justus. Where was his house located? All right, it's located next to the synagogue. More about that in just a little bit. And what is said about this fella? He worshiped God. Now, when we say to someone, if I say Ray worships God, we would probably understand that to mean what?
He's a Christian.
He's a Christian. That's sort of how we use this word. But if we're looking at this in the Bible and it says he worshiped God, do you think he's saying he was a Christian or something else is being expressed?
He was living next door to the synagogue, so
he's probably a Jew.
Well, he could have also been, in, especially when you look at Luke and how he talks about Gentiles in the book of Acts, I'd be inclined to think that he was a Gentile. It could be that he was a Jew, but he's certainly not a Christian. Luke does not identify him in that way. So he's either a Jew or a practicing Jew who's got his house next to the synagogue, or he is a Gentile. And like I say, I do favor that one. Assuming that he is a Gentile, even though obviously from birth he's not a Jew, if he is a Gentile, what do we know about him? Who's he remind us of? Yeah, he kind of reminds you of Cornelius. Here is he's apparently a good man. And he's apparently a man interested in spiritual things. He wants to do what's right. So right over there with the Jews now, and from where he was in life, the knowledge that he had, that certainly made the most sense, and I think that speaks very, very well of him. And God was willing to use him, even though he was kind of on the outside. Here's an example, and we'll see if we can, as a class, I can give you some illustrations if some don't come to mind or if you're not familiar with this. But there have been times throughout the Christian era, and you could go back and look at the era prior to that as well, but thinking about terms in Christianity, there have been times where God has used non-Christians individually or collectively sometimes, to advance the gospel or help God's people. True or false? It's true. Can you think of some illustrations? Well, I'm thinking, yeah, that would be true if we go to the Old Testament. But let's think about the New Testament era. But you're right, Rahab offered lodging. And if we use that as our starting point in the New Testament, do we have sometimes non-Christians offering lodging to people? I've had that experience. I stayed in the house of someone that I believe was just described as a witch doctor. There were some people on that particular trip who said, I don't want to stay there. I said, I'll stay with him. So, you know, I'm still here. I don't think I got hexed. But he was involved with some things, apparently the occult, but still had an interest in spiritual things. And I thought, well, if we're trying to reach the guy, why not? I mean, we got a free night there. We had to find houses for a number of people. Why not stay there with him? Maybe he'll ask some questions. And if I get whacked, well, you know, I guess I tried to die in service to Christ there on a foreign field. That's okay by me. But there have been non-Christians who have offered houses to Christians. What about some other examples? Non-Christians helping. Okay, you might have an area, especially down south, where a lot of Christians, and you, with a disaster, people just show up. Sometimes it's an organization, and they say, we're going to help you. Your church building was blown down by the tornado, and we're going to help you rebuild it. Well, that's nice, and that's helpful. So when we think about disasters, sometimes it happens there. What else? Steve?
With a Good Samaritan, would that be an example?
All right. You have a Christian. The fella comes up, and he says, look, your car is broken down. Yeah, I was headed to services. I can get you to services. You know, you just need a jump, or looks like a spark plug cable got disconnected, those kinds of things. Sometimes non-Christians have provided Christians with food and even clothing, different things. So it's not uncommon for that to happen in the world, and here we have an example of that. Transportation as well. I was once, I don't know, a couple of you probably know this story, but I was one of the first people, well, I was the first American that some people had seen in Ukraine. And one of the places where I went were people, it was almost like Africa, where they want to touch the new guy. And one of the places was a Ukrainian summer camp. They'd never seen an American before except for TV, and they were just thrilled at that. So I spent a couple days up there, I think, teaching, and then it was time for me to go home. Well, they had changed the rules, and I was without a visa at the time. No visa was required when I left. I got in the country, a visa was required, and the advice was you just continue on and try to get it worked out. Well, the people, they were non-Christians. They appreciated the teaching that was done, and they said, we need to get you back to where you need to be. If this story sounds familiar, somebody stop me. Sound familiar? Okay. And they said, we've got a camp ambulance. Gas is tight, but we will put you in the ambulance, and we will take you back. I said, okay. So they said, get in the back, lie down. Well, I thought, well, that was kind of odd. So I did, and then they threw a sheet over me. And I thought, well, that's really peculiar. And then it was kind of, you know, shh. Well, I got the shh part, even though I couldn't speak Russian. And then you know, kind of watching what's going on, they take out a doctor and a nurse uniform and dress up. And I thought, well, this is really peculiar. And again, shh. So they drove for what seemed like an hour and a half. And along the way, there was a stop. And there was a lengthy conversation. I have no idea what that was, but later I learned that they took me through a restricted military area. That was a shortcut. And since Gat was, but they were so grateful, they wanted to get me home and get me home in the best way for them and me. And afterwards, I thought, yikes. You know, an American in a military restricted zone, in an ambulance with a fake doctor and a fake nurse, me covered up as a patient. I'm sure they lied about me. And then when they check things out, I've got a passport, but I don't have a visa. So, a very interesting trip. And some other things have happened, but there, in that particular case, I was helped by non-Christians. And not only was I helped by non-Christians, I was helped by non-Christians, Steve, who kind of fall into the same category as Rahab. You know, she lied. I had people who surely lied because they didn't come back and pull up the sheet. I don't know if they said I was dead or I was just really sick. But anyway, they talked their way through that checkpoint. So when I think about non-Christians helping, I can raise my hand and say, amen, that is true. And Paul had that same kind of experience.
Well, we may think it's a really good example. Was Gamaliel was a Pharisee, and he stood up and said, leave these people alone.
Yeah.
Now, you don't know exactly what he had in mind. It may have simply been his worldly wisdom, the way he expressed it, but still, the example of a non-Christian helping them.
Exactly right. It can be a political leader. It might be a religious leader. Maybe it is someone who's senior in management in an organization and says, look, for these people who have this religious conviction, we're going to carve out. It could be a judge. So there are a lot of different ways that God says, look, I can work in the world and with non-Christians, work in such a way where they can aid you and assist you, and it really gets interesting. God apparently looks favorably on that kind of thing because justice, this justice, Titus justice, is mentioned in the New Testament. And when you think about all the people in human history, New Testament times, that could have been mentioned, not very many. I mean, it's minuscule, less than that as far as the number of people. I think this guy is important for some other reasons as well. There would be some people who have the idea, I have my church, I don't want to change. You know, I'm happy with my faith. But apparently this guy is willing to have Paul and willing to consider that there might be another way to go other than Judaism. Now, if you think about justice, this is not the first time we read about a justice in the New Testament. Anybody remember another justice earlier in the book of Acts? Well, it was time to replace an apostle, remember? And the guy who wasn't selected, his name was Justice. Now, same name, but it's not going to be the same person. Then you've got a third guy named Justice. This is going to be over in the book of Colossians, Colossians chapter 4 and verse 11. I'll not run the reference, but there you read about the Jesus, or the Justice who is called Jesus. Along with this Justice, who else do we have? We've got a man named Crispus. And who's Crispus? He is a leader, he's a ruler, he's the ruler of the synagogue. This man becomes a Christian. The Bible says he and who else? He and his house. So there could have been a wife there. There could have been children there old enough to obey the gospel. He may have had household servants. I'm not sure how large that house was. What did he do? The Bible says he believed in the Lord. Here's another case in the book of, or another example in the book of Acts where people see that word belief and they just hop off the train and say, aha. Kind of like Acts chapter 16. That was all he did. Well, it doesn't say he believed only. And we've got here, as we've talked about before, you have a synecdoche. You have a part for the whole. Sometimes belief is mentioned. Sometimes repentance is mentioned. Sometimes baptism is mentioned. The whole plan is not necessarily given every time we read about conversions in the book of Acts. We also saw that back in Acts chapter 11 and verse 14. Judy?
But it says that when they heard and believing and being baptized, so it says that he was baptized.
Yes, Luke did not stop with belief. Sometimes people, though, do. When you look at the other New Testament writers, they sort of fill in the extra blanks. You may remember from Romans chapter 10 and verse 17, Paul said faith. Well, that's what we've got here. But that faith has to come from somewhere. He said it comes from where? It comes by hearing. Well, James tells us, is it enough to hear? No. The man who hears but doesn't obey is like a guy who has living faith or dead faith. Your faith is dead. Even the demons have that. They believe and shudder. But we've got to okay. I'll add a point to that as well in just a second. But with that belief, we know from Acts chapter 17, the previous chapter, Paul said, all men where?
Everywhere
need to repent. So that's not mentioned here in Acts chapter 18, but Paul said all men everywhere. That would certainly include Corinth. And then you've got confession, and you've also finally got the baptism, which he does mention here. The acts of believing and baptism are described with the present tense as ongoing action. So you begin to see that there were at least a fair amount of conversions here. People continued to believe, and that belief they continued to obey, which of course included the act of baptism. Others, and we've seen this before in the book of Acts, since Luke talks about with all his house, they became Christians. Well, what must have happened here? And since baptism is mentioned, all his house, baptism, that's kind of like one plus one must equal two, which in this case, in their mind, the two is all the house baptized. That must be infant baptism, right? That's what they conclude. Well, a couple problems with that. Number one, if they believed, then they had to be old enough to accomplish that. You can't have a newborn believe the gospel. That just doesn't work. I mean, we've got some smart kids today, but they're not quite that smart, at least not yet. So people come to this sometimes with a preconceived idea and then hope that that's going to be established by the text. It's not there. For us, though, I think that there are multiple examples of perhaps God's providence. Number one, when you think about Paul, we kind of touched on this at the beginning of the class. Let's go back and review it for just a second. He comes to Corinth. Is he independently wealthy? He's just got a ton of money that he can draw from? He needs a job. He needs some cash. He needs a place to stay. He's going to have to get some food. And he comes with all those things, and what happens? All right, he gets a job. And he gets a place to stay. He's got a place to eat. Everything's working out for him. So was that God's providence? It certainly would be consistent with God's providence, even though that is not specifically mentioned. Then you have some other examples here that I think are possibly providential. Apparently there is now a need for Paul to go to a new place, either to live or perhaps to continue to preach the gospel. Maybe he needs a larger home for people to come in. And guess what? All right, God says, I've got a new place for you. This guy by the name of Justice, you know, his house, whatever Paul had a need for concerning another place, God provides that as well. So house number one, house number two. And then this place is not only provided for whatever purpose Paul needed, but what about the location of the place? I mean, it's right next. If there are any Jews to pick up, or, you know, maybe some haven't been coming for a little while, I mean, they're right on the way. So it's interesting. God says, I can provide a place, and I can provide the right location for you. If you think about that in terms of today, practically, what would that mean for a Christian? God says, I can provide you the right place to live. There was someone who talked to me not very long ago, wanted to come to Elkhart County, and said, look, I need a place to live, and every place is really expensive. I'm just not sure I can make it work. I said, well, person's a Christian. I said, have you tried a prayer of faith? I said, let's try that. And you know what? They found a spot. They found a spot that worked for them. Everything looked like it was closed. When we think about a job, can God help us providentially get a job? Yes, the right job, the right place, the right time, the right pay, the right step in the ladder, if we're trying to climb the ladder, all those things, if we'll seek him in faith, he can provide the right things at the right times. But that's not perhaps the only example, the final example of Corinth as well. Let's think about this guy who's converted, Crispus. What's his job? Or religiously, what position is he fulfilling? He's a leader where? In synagogue. Now, if we back up just a few verses, what's going on in Paul's life? Everything is rosy or not going so well? What do we talk about? Remember the word blaspheme? You remember that resisting that we talked about? Paul's testifying and people are just trying to shut him down. Who are those opponents? The Jews. And the Jews are from where? The synagogue. But who rules the synagogue? Crispus. So if you go over and you yank the ruler out of the synagogue, now if you do that by force, is that probably going to put things in a little bit of chaos? Well, yeah. But what if you don't do that by force? What if you go and take this guy out, either the head guy or at least one of the main guys, one of the top guys, if not the number one fella, and you remove him and you put him where? Over with Paul. Now you've got this thorn in the flesh preacher, Paul, preaching, and Crispus, your leader, your ruler, your head, is over there with him. What do you think that's going to do to the opposition? It's going to kink it up a little bit, I would think. Because now you're going to have to find, and somebody might have stepped forward quickly and been a leader. But that, I think, is one more great example of God's providence. So it may have given him a little bit of a break. For us, once again, the lesson is trust God, believe that in his providence he really can deliver, and he will. But that is the key. Going back, as we're talking about in the Wednesday night class, faith. That's where it begins, that's where it ends, and that's what needs to be taking place in the middle. God says, if you truly trust me, I want to help, I can help, and I will help. Anything that you want to discuss before we pick up with Acts chapter 18, verses 9 and 10? Okay, let's see, we've got about 17 minutes left, and there's another and. The Lord said unto Paul in the night by a vision, be not afraid, but speak, and hold not thy peace. For I am with thee, and no man shall set on thee to harm thee, for I have much people in this city. I don't know what everybody thinks about the apostles, but I sort of get the impression sometimes that there are people, members of the church and people who are not, who have this image of the apostles that before Jesus goes to the cross, they have weaknesses and they have fears and their faith isn't always what it should be. And that's true, isn't it? The apostles had a lot of failings. I mean, they see Jesus coming out in the water during a storm and it's a ghost. And Lord, you can't go down to Jerusalem. You're going to be killed. They really struggle. But maybe the image is, wrongly, but perhaps our image is that after Jesus comes to the resurrection and they begin to preach, you've got the great preaching by Peter on the day of Pentecost, and you've got Peter going to jail, and the angel delivers him. And maybe our mental image of the apostles is they had it all worked out. Their faith was never imperfect. They never struggled. They just were the golden boys. Well, that's not really the picture that we get. I mean, they were so much better and stronger after Jesus was raised from the dead, but there were also periods where they struggled, and that's what we see here. Acts 18 and verse 9 tells us that Paul was not fearless. Here you have, all the apostles were great, but here you have one who is someone who is especially prominent in the New Testament, and as he thinks about evangelizing Corinth, he is somewhat unnerved by that. The next time you go into a situation as a Christian and you're thinking, I am a little nervous, and maybe that is surgery, or maybe you're trying to talk to someone about the gospel, or maybe it's something work-related, maybe it's something family-related, you're thinking, I don't know how I'm going to get through this as a parent, whatever that might be, if it's a little unnerving, know that that is not something that God looks at you and says, boy, you know, this person is really disappointing me, I'm just going to get rid of them. Could God have said, I'm going to replace Paul? He should have more faith in me than he does, and he's somewhat unnerved at this time. I'm going to dump him and get somebody else. He could have, but he didn't do that. God stuck with him. Not only did God stick with him, God helped him. He knew that this weak moment would come for Paul, just like he knows and sees our times of weakness, and here he specifically tells us that some of his best servants struggle. How did he help him? He gave him a vision at what time of day? He gives him a vision at night. And this is not the only time that Paul has a vision. But the vision begins by acknowledging something, doesn't it? Before getting into what God says I'm going to do, this is what I'm telling you that you need to do. And what is that? Don't fear. Now it's interesting, as you look at the original text, this is one of those constructions which seems to indicate the halting, the stopping of an action in progress. For example, maybe you've had, I used this as a sermon illustration not long ago. I saw a lady in a public place. Someone was getting close to her, and she said, halt, stop, far enough, social distance, stay 6 feet away. So there are times in life where an action in progress, we call on a person to stop, and that's what God is doing to Paul. He is saying, stop your fear, halt your fear, end your fear, fear no more. This is something I see that you're engaged in and you need to get rid of it. Can you see some application there for us? Or perhaps there's behavior that's inconsistent with God's will. Well, what do we do with kids? The child is out there slapping the sister, and what do we say? Stop it! You know, you're involved in that activity. That's wrong. Put that to an end. Don't continue. And there are times where God says to his people, at least through his word, in this case with a vision, this is what you need to do. God says, instead of fear, I want you to go and
do not be silent.
or speak, either one. But he has it expressed in two ways. I think there's something a little bit before that, isn't there?
Yeah, it does say go on, speak.
All right, speak, that's clear enough. But if some emphasis is needed, he goes on to say, do not hold your peace. You need to go out and you need to preach the gospel of Christ. Interestingly, as we look at God's directions sometimes, and the same is true for us, sometimes directions may be more or less emphatic. Sometimes they may be longer or shorter. But here God is very emphatic and he stretches it out a little bit. You know, stop this, do this, and if there's any doubt, here's this additional information as well. When you look at verse 10, you have some information as far as why Paul was to confidently declare the gospel of Christ in the city of Corinth. The first reason is what? God says, I am with you. Now that's expressed with the present tense. God says, I am continuing to be with you. Could God have expressed the point in a slightly different way? There are already some converts at Corinth, weren't there? Some people had become Christians. So could God have said, I'm with the church, it's going to be okay?
Sure.
Yeah. And could he have said, I'm going to just kind of look after you from time to time? Trust me. Well, he could have, and people sometimes hear that, don't they? You know, I'll come in and look on you, look after you from time to time. You know, I'll check on you once a week, or at least once a month, I'll look in on you. But God didn't say that. He said, I am with you. Now, if a person says that, and a person really means that, I am with you, what kind of connotation are we trying to express?
Always.
It's constant. Now, for us, that's difficult. If I say to Steve, I'm always going to be with you, well, we're probably going to part company a little later today, but or we might spend the whole day together, say, I'm going to be with you. But then chances are, you know, he's going to go off somewhere and go to sleep, and the same will be true for me. But God's promise is 24/7, regardless of where you are, regardless of when it is, God says, I, Jesus Christ, am going to be with you. Now, that's comforting. But is this promise just for Paul? Thinking about the Great Commission. I will be with you how often, how long? Always. That, I think, is an important time for us. When we get to a time in life where things are hard, there's a crisis, uncertain what to do, it's good to just kind of mentally step back a little bit and say, I am not alone. God is with me. I may not see the deliverance right now. I'm not sure how this is going to turn out. I need some other options that are not on the table right now. But I know as a Christian that God is with me. And that gets back to the faith that we've been talking about. Gary?
And as you were talking about providence earlier, God will put you in the right place, will get you the right job, whatever. But even if you're trying to decide between two jobs, and this happened with me recently, and they both look really, really good, and you're like, which one would be better for my faith? Which one does God want me to have? And then you think, well, even if I choose, quote unquote, the wrong one, he's still going to be with me.
Yes.
And so that, when I was making my decision a while back, that helped me out.
It is, because we've talked about before the fact that there is God's ideal will, but that's often not realized because we do have free choice and human will. So we might head off on D track instead of A track, but with God, he can use that A track, and if we're really trying to do what's right, eventually move that over to the A track, or maybe even the A plus track. But it gets down to having that trust, having that faith, and really trying to apply that information in life. So we're grateful for the new job and thankful for the illustration. Anybody else? A couple more things to tell you. Let's think about the foreknowledge that we have expressed in verse 10. God said, how many people would harm Paul? There would not be a single person. No individual would harm Paul. Now, that might be important because Paul had or had not been harmed in some other places. He'd been viciously attacked. Now, if you, for example, think about someone who has been attacked by a dog, and I mean attacked by the dog, the legs have been bitten and the arms have been bitten, skin's been torn off the face. They get out of the hospital. 6 months later, they go to somebody's house, and from woof, 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 from around the house comes a couple of big Dobermans or German Shepherds. What do you think is going to go through their mind? Well, yeah, I think how fast can I run and which direction is probably going to be headed through the mind, but what else?
Fear.
Yes. That image of the attack comes back because you are exposed to that once again. Now, if you're Paul and you're getting this, you will not be hurt. No man. I'm with you. Not a single person is going to come and harm you. For us, it might be a little bit of a difficulty weighing those two things, putting them together. God, I know what you said, and I know what happened to me. I really want to believe that. Maybe he struggled with that a little bit. I don't know. But God says you don't have to think about those things. For example, Philippi, you know, you're stoned and all the other bad things that happened to him, but God says that is not going to take place here. Now, the harm in this context, we emphasized the physical just a moment ago. I do think that that is true, but it may also, at least in my mind, extend beyond that. Had Paul been arrested, or at least treated like he'd been arrested? Yeah, I mean, we think about him being drug off to the Philippian prison, and when we think about no harm, you don't have to worry about arrest, you don't have to worry about trials, those kinds of things. It would be like on a ship, and the person would say, it's smooth sailing, you're not going to have any problems with wind, and the waves are not going to be an issue, it's going to be very, very peaceful. There could have also, this is another line of thought, and I think there's probably some truth in it, I don't know that I really believe that this is the primary point, but if you're Paul, and you're preaching, you would like to establish a congregation and probably make sure that it goes and grows and matures. But in the back of your mind, do you not have some concerns? Well, you would, and what would a couple of those concerns be? I've worked with these people, helped these people learn the truth, and they're headed off, but now what might happen? All right. False doctrine might infect the church, or maybe they just become apathetic and they no longer want to follow Christ, or maybe there's going to be persecution and all of my efforts are going to be wasted. I don't think that that's really the fear here. The fear actually seems to be a true fear, like the dog fear that I mentioned, that I'm going to have some of the same negative experiences and I really don't want to go through those things again. God says, I'm going to be with you. A cross-reference for us would be Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 6. The Hebrew writer specifically says that God will be with his people. That's a promise that we need to keep before us. As we think about these verses, another distinction I think that I want to make is a distinction between fear and courage. Fear and courage. I'll start with this question. Courage, would you say that it is the absence of fear? Courage, is it the absence of fear?
No.
I think that would be the majority answer, and that would be the correct answer. There have been a lot of people who have been courageous, but they were fearful. Ideally, when we think about courage, people are going to be doing what's right and not have fear. But it is possible to do what's right and still be struggling with some of those kinds of things. Paul, as he thinks about this, perhaps a little bit later in life, he's writing to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 7, a younger Timothy, a younger man, and he says, God did not give us a spirit of fearfulness. And maybe as he reflects on that information, he's thinking back that I think with people in general, as you get older, I know, I think of our three elders, all three would say this. I'm one of the three, obviously, so I'll just kind of try to speak on behalf of the other two, but not get real specific. I think both of them would tell you that over the years, they've toughened up some. There were some things in the earlier years that they would have said, we don't want to talk about this with somebody, or we're kind of concerned about going and trying to make this presentation. I know that for me, I've kind of toughened up over the years, able to talk to some people in a more comfortable way about some things. Sometimes they're not easy things, and I think that's true for all of our elders, and I think for a lot of people generally, as life progresses, that is something that they get better at. You still may sometimes have some lingering doubts or concerns, but for whatever reason, maybe it's a lack of sense as the years go by, you lose some of it, or maybe you just get forgetful, or maybe there's less care about some things, but people sometimes do seem to get better, and hopefully as a Christian, that's one of the qualities that we pick up, that we are more and more confident, less and less fearful, and more courageous as we go through life. All right, Stan. I didn't want to call on you, but you raised your hand, so now I will. Thank you.
No, I agree entirely with what you said, and I'm going to go off in a little different direction. Perfect play, yes, about.
Sure.
And I think that that comes with maturity. And the more you get to know God, the more you get to know about Him, the greater your love becomes, the more you have faith in Him, the less fearful that you become.
Yes. Didn't have that passage down. I'm going to put that in the notes, but that is right. That love and that fear, they are mutually exclusive, and little by little, if you increase here, this decreases. Steve?
You can have fear, or you can, but you can give into it, or maybe you don't give into it. If you give into fear, then the fear is going to get the best of you.
It will.
If you don't give into it, you go boldly, your courage is, you know, you still have fear, but yeah. Stop you from doing it.
Yeah, it's like poison. It doesn't take very much of it to start affecting the body, and then it just gets worse and worse and worse. And if you don't halt that or stop that like God commanded Paul, you're exactly right. One other quick point that I want to make, and then we'll ask for hands one more time. He makes this great promise in verse 10, but look down at verse 12. But when Galileo was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews with one accord, what'd they do? Rose up against Paul and they brought him to the judgment seat. So God says, look, nobody's going to lay a hand on you. But two verses later, what do we find? There is opposition. So when God says there's not going to be anybody that lays a hand on you, and let's complete the story a little bit, what happens?
Galileo said, go away.
Yes. I don't want to have it. As you look at the end of verse 17, Galileo cared for how many of these things? None of these things. It's kind of like Trump and some of the cases that he's had dismissed. We don't want to hear it. You know, we're not interested in that stuff. You don't have a case. And sometimes a judge does that. And that's really what happened here. So God makes this promise, and you might say it's a very specific promise. Nobody is going to be able to bring you to trial, and that didn't happen. Nobody is going to be able to harm you. And when you look at God's promises, sometimes people can read too much or too little into them. But you always want to make sure that you are carefully studying God's promises, because what He has promised, that will be true without fail.